Retaliation and all this.
Welcome, everyone. I will now call the House Committee on Health Care for February 10th, 2010 to order. We have a fairly full schedule today, and as usual, we will be moving some things out of order because of other kind of scheduling problems. So first up, we're going to hold a public hearing on House Bill 4105 because Representative Esquivel needs to be someplace else. As I can imagine, a lot of you need to be, or would rather be someplace else. But.
Do you have a note, Senator Representative Esquivel?
He's on his word of honor. So I hereby open a public hearing on House Bill 4105. You're on, sir.
Thank you. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. Colleagues, I bring in front of you a bill that I'm sure will probably not ever get a chance to maybe be on the floor. But I bring it to you for a purpose. And that purpose to me is to understand what we as legislators have done to the cost of a premium in the state of Oregon. I have a handout, and if you'll see all the mandates that this body has piled on top of people's policy. I believe, and I was unable to, I couldn't get it through the state, and I couldn't get it through the local brokers because it's pretty intensive. But some of these are 0.5% here, 0.5% there, but some of them are 7 to 10% addition onto your premium. The cost to the end user can vary from about 35 to 50%. And when I get that information, I will come back again in front of this body to show a starking reality. And I have been part of the problem as much as anyone in this room. Some of these mandates are mine. But I didn't realize the cause and effect. We talk in this state about having health care available to people, yet we, the legislature, keep putting it out of their reach with higher costs and higher costs and higher costs. And there's nothing wrong with these mandates. Every one of them is a good mandate. Don't misunderstand me. But I want us to think about what we're doing. What we're doing to the end user. Why not allow someone that's paying $1,000 for a premium for a certain kind of a basic coverage to be able to purchase that for $500 and then have a cafeteria-style approach to this health care? There's many, many things on here that individuals need and they should purchase. And there's many things that a lot of us do not need, but we're required to purchase. The trickle-down effect is, what does that affect the people that are scraping by just enough to get their health care premium? Wouldn't it be nice if we reconsider this to allow these people to go across the state line, allow them to get their basic coverage, catastrophic coverage, at half the price? So, that's about all I have to say. I just brought it up so we could take a good, hard look at what we're doing as legislators.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Nope. All right. Anyone?
Well, I think Representative Green.
Representative Esquivel, I really like to ask a couple of questions. You know, what it seems to me this bill does is essentially allows people to come into Oregon and not be regulated by Oregon insurance regulations. If you want to do away with mandates, why don't we just go at them directly? Or go into the mandates and allow exceptions for Oregon companies otherwise regulated.
Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick. Good question, but you know, if we can open this up to a wider market for people where there's more competition, that should be beneficial. In Oregon, what do we have, 7 companies? Give or take a few? Whereas there's about 400 out there nationwide. And you say that we don't regulate them. Well, yeah, we don't. But other states do.
Can I follow up?
Please.
Can I give an example from, you're a real estate agent, is that right, as a profession? And I expect your profession...
Well, I used to be until the market went away.
I hope it's coming back. But that's an occupation that's regulated by states, and various states regulate it in various ways. I mean, it would be the same thing, it would seem to me, if there's some state that doesn't regulate the disclosure and a variety of other things that real estate agents need to do. It would be improper to bring them in from Oklahoma or you pick a state and allow companies from there to come in and compete unfairly with Oregon agents who have to follow the regulations of the state. It seems to me this is analogous to that situation, or physicians who are regulated in Guam differently than in Oregon, allow them to come in and practice medicine in the state. I mean, we have a... Doesn't this fly in the face of that sort of thing?
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Thompson, I guess what I look at very simplistically, first of all, we have reciprocal agreements in real estate, so, you know, I'm not sure that applies. But on the other hand, are we here to help the people, or are we here to control? Other states regulate insurance companies as well as we do, or maybe even better. But can't we get a reciprocal agreement with a state that where we don't have to have the mandate?
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Yeah. Dr. Doherty.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel, I have a procedural question. There are other states that you can kind of pick, or other states that don't have as many mandates. Now, if I, for example, want to go to another state and I'm going to get a plan that doesn't cover XYZ and maybe on this list like bilateral cochlear implants, and all of a sudden I need one, but my neighbor can get it because of the mandates and they got the insurance in Oregon, and I know this is way in the future, but is there some sort of a waiver, or I abrogate my rights to go through after the insurance company because they don't cover something in the policy that I purchased, but it does in everybody else in Oregon? Is there some sort of a system that they've worked for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, I think what you're talking about is choice. You've made a choice. I've made a choice. I've decided to pay more. You decided not to. I believe in a cafeteria-style approach, and if I make the wrong choice, then that should be my responsibility. It shouldn't be your responsibility. I firmly believe that. But more importantly, everyone out here has a worry about catastrophic situations that will break them. If you have a certain situation that may not, you know, like you get the flu, or you have something, you know, where you cut a finger or something like that, that's one issue. But if you, like, lose a limb or something like that, that can take your whole household down with it. And that's what I think what we need to have is a basic coverage for all people and allow that to be affordable to people. Right now, in the state of Oregon, the way it looks, I mean, there's 40-some mandates here, and I'll tell you, folks, there aren't the mandates that we passed last time on here as well. So that adds on to it. So I think we have about 46 now, the way I figure. If we can cut your premium in half, then you still have the same basic coverage. Why is that bad?
Well, no, I was just asking for a waiver because, I mean, you're a gentleman, you're a man of your word, but there are other people going, well, I know I didn't sign up for this, but now I need it, and my neighbor gets it, and I don't, I'm going to sue the insurance company. So I just wondered whether there had been discussion about, you know, I waive my right to sue the insurance company because I don't have the same coverage as the person next door.
Well,
I wouldn't do that, but other people would.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, you're talking about an individual that should be working with their broker, their local broker, to find out what's the best plan for them. That's no different than a car insurance. You have certain car insurances that cover this, cover that. Some of them don't cover as well. Some of them cover better. You have the same thing with property insurance.
So education is part of it.
Education has to be part of it, and that's why you have a broker.
Thank you.
I don't know I need to prolong the discussion. I guess my problem is with some of the really expensive treatments. If we don't mandate these things, then how do they ever occur? Like, for example, we now know autism is treatable, and I've been working to add that as a mandate because we could prevent some of that terrible disorder if we had it covered. Or Chair Greenlick recently sent us one that was really kind of a heart stopper. It's cystic fibrosis. There's a medicine that will be effective in about 5% of the cases that are identified through genes at a whopping $300,000 a year. So I don't know the answers to those, but they sure pose difficult questions when you sit here on this committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kinnerman, that will happen, period. Yeah. We all know that. But on the other hand, why am I paying for maternity benefits? I may look like I need it, but I really don't at my age. Why do I have to pay for that? I paid for mine. But the key is affordability, because if you don't have affordability to people to acquire any sort of a base policy, it's going to raise your cost again. Because a lot of people don't have insurance. We all admit that. Why? Well, it's too expensive. Why? I'm pointing out one thing here. It's this legislative body that may be part of the problem. That's all I'm saying.
Richie Hoyle.
So, and thank you so much. I, you know, always appreciate creative ideas to see what we can do to provide health coverage to people for less money. However, although you don't or won't need coverage for maternity care or pregnancy, I don't need coverage for prostate cancer or vasectomies. And yet, if we have a pool of people that have, or, you know, one of the things that we passed in 2007 was mental health parity. I mean, it's very important that if we as a group can pay into a fund that covers basic health care, although you don't need maternity and pregnancy care, by covering those things, making sure that birth and prenatal care is covered, that means that we don't have to pay for the outcomes of bad births. And the people that are born are the ones that will be taking care of you when you are a senior. I mean, it's like saying, why should I pay for schools if my children aren't going to schools? Well, because investing in good schools is something that's essential for the rest of our society, and is also something that can attract businesses if we invest in our infrastructure. At the end of the day, we passed certain bills that reflect what our values are in Oregon. We covered the things that we felt would lead to better health. And maybe we don't agree with all of them, and we can talk about that on a case-by-case basis. But again, I believe in states' rights. I believe in the fact that we as a legislature looked at these bills and passed things that made sure that we have the appropriate safety net, that we have an economy of scale. If we have enough people paying into a fund and we cover those things that do need to be covered, then we can have a healthier society. And that benefits you and it benefits me. But the other thing I'd like to say is, in those states that don't have as many or the same mandates, they don't necessarily have lower costs for their health insurance. I mean, it isn't half necessarily. So I think we should look at this on a case-by-case basis. And again, I appreciate what you've brought forward, but, you know, I haven't gotten in a car accident, but I still pay for my car insurance, and that makes a difference so that other people, when they get in an accident, can have that coverage. So I think that the laws that we pass represent the values of Oregonians and how we look at health care, and I would be opposed to allowing unregulated insurance companies to come into our state.
Mr. Co-Chair Thompson, Representative Hoyle, as I stated in the first place, if you'll remember correctly, this will no go nowhere, I understand that. But what I'm bringing to light is what you do up there at that dais when you say yes on mandates. You're making it more difficult for people to get insurance. We all do it. I've done it. And I've all voted yes on it. What I'm saying is, before you push that yes button, let's be thinking of the cause and effect, because we're not asking the what now questions.
Right.
And we're responsible.
We can continue this discussion offline. You both have excellent points. And you have some place you said you need to be.
Yes, I have to go to Fort Valley.
A clarification. I have Pat Allen, Lou Savage, or Jeanette
Thank
Holman.
You, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Escobar.
In line, is that, did you have testimony or were questions or? Okay.
Short and sweet.
Fine.
Mr. Chairman, maybe short and sweet.
Yeah. Make it as short as you can. I would appreciate it.
We're,
as you might expect, already behind schedule. So.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Jeanette Holman from the Insurance Division of DCBS. Pat Allen and Lou Savage were number one and number two, but they're down doing confirmation hearings.
Yeah.
Just very briefly, I wanted to raise some issues with this bill that it sounds like you're pretty well aware of some of them. This bill would have an impact on consumers in a number of ways. It would impact our ability to oversee the financial regulation of these companies to make sure they have the resources to pay claims, because if they're excluded from the insurance code, we lose all of our regulatory authority over them completely. We would lose authority over the forms that they use. We'd lose authority over the rate regulation, which we do now for individuals and small businesses. They wouldn't have access to the resources of our consumer advocacy section and our enforcement and investigation sections would not be able to look into any complaints with these folks. For industry, it would put our domestic insurers at quite a disadvantage, because they would still be required to comply with the mandates. What we would anticipate happening is we would lose those domestic insurers. They would move out of state. And finally, I assume you have the fiscal impact that we put together on this. The revenue loss is quite heavy.
We do have the fiscal impact, yes.
And other than that, I'd be glad to answer questions. Just wanted to be here, so if you do have questions, we can answer them.
Any brief questions from the panel? None. I thank you.
Thank you. And if you have questions later, please contact
us. Oh, I'm sure we will. Thank you very much. Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 4105, and we will open a work session on House Bill 4074. And it seems like we're missing a fair number of people, like the co-chair.
Testifying in another committee.
Yeah, okay. Any discussion?
Are you open? We're in a work session.
We're in a work session.
Would you like a motion on this?
I think we would like a motion.
I see.
That has to go to revenue.
And has it, there were no amendments. Is that right, Mr. Chair?
Which one are we on? I'm sorry.
On
4074.
4074. This is the one that permits insurers
and
to pay.
And it moves on to revenue.
So we'll need a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that we send House Bill 4074 to the Revenue Committee with the due pass recommendation.
By prior reference.
By prior reference. By prior let's see, I've botched that a little bit. By prior reference, I move that we forward House Bill 4074 with the due pass recommendation.
Moving 4074 to the Revenue.
Okay. I'm sorry, did you make the motion?
Well, I did. It probably was a little bit. It was close. Shall I do it again?
No. Would you like to refresh that motion?
Mr. Chair, let me try this again and with everyone's indulgence. I move House Bill 4074 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. That's more better.
Okay. I don't want anybody to think that we depend on staff to get through some of this stuff, but I think you just saw the worst of that. Commissioner Kenimer moves that House Bill 4074 move to the floor, move to...
That's right.
Move to the floor with due pass recommendation. And then it be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion on the motion? Representative
yes,
Kenny Geyer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I received a letter today from Tax Fairness Oregon. I don't know if that was, if all of you received it, but it raises a question about the second part of the plan, which is the tax deduction part of the plan. So I loved the testimony last time. I loved the idea of the $1,000, and I think that obesity, tobacco use are huge issues, and I thought this was a really innovative way to do it. And I fully support the first part, but I thought that the concern that was raised in the letter about does giving the tax deduction portion, which is 7.2% is the average amount that that Oregonians pay in their income tax, and so if we give a tax deduction to that $1,000, it's basically $72. You know, I completely agree the $1,000 could be a really great incentive. I think that's fantastic. And doing whatever we need to do legislatively to permit that, I think, is great. But my question comes in, you know, is the $72 per person that we will lose in tax revenue, is that an added incentive enough for people to want to do this program, or is the $1,000 enough? Is it really going to make a difference, 1,000 to 1,072? That was not an issue that was raised in our public hearing, but I thought it was a very compelling point, and I would love to have some discussion on that particular piece of it.
Any discussion?
You know, I think, Mr. Chair, if I may,
please,
and Representative, I guess it's one of the reasons it has a referral to revenue. I guess as the policy committee, our decision here is principally about do we think this is a good idea?
Mm-hmm.
Their job is to determine whether or not we can afford and it's an appropriate revenue decision. And so that's why we have the differentiating of committees. Ours is a policy committee, theirs is revenue. So I would kind of defer on that, although there is a mixture, and I can see why one might agree or disagree on the realization that it has an impact, just like anything else we do.
So, satisfy you?
I think that's okay. You know, I hope that the issue gets raised there, whether that's really enough of incentive to forego the tax benefit that we would get. The other consideration could be, you know, is there a way to study that, have a report in 2 years to say, did that tax incentive portion of it provide enough of a difference in incentive that people are doing this? You know, do we need to forego the tax revenue, and is that $72 piece or whatever that would be enough of an added incentive? Perhaps that could be considered at the revenue committee then.
Yeah, I personally would prefer to do that because tax impact is really beyond the scope of the healthcare policy committee. I understand what you're saying,
yeah,
and it's a good point. But I think at this point, I would prefer to move it on to revenue, let them deal with that. And Madam, could you get that information referred to them that we had this discussion so that they know that we are concerned about that part, or a concern was expressed about that part?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Anything else before we call the question? Okay. Motion has been made. Would you call the question, please? Or call for vote.
Call the roll.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenimer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenland?
Excuse.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye. Okay, House Bill 4074 is on its way to the Revenue Committee, and I wish it well.
Mr. Chair, if I may recommend you be more subtle.
You want to wait for a minute to come back? Okay.
I don't care, as long as we can pass it.
Okay. House Bill 4122 will not be moving forward. We are establishing a committee work force on that and work group, and that will be chaired by myself and Representative Bailey with possibly a lot of other input. That's as far as we're going with that today. I'm going to hold House Bill 4128 and give the co-chair a brief period of time to come back before we move it. And with that, is Representative Wisnant here?
He left just a moment ago.
Okay, we can get started. So we've got other people.
Okay, let's move to open a public hearing on House Bill 4027.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you will recall that House Bill 4027 we heard on, what day is today? We heard on Wednesday. This provides immunity from civil liability to persons who are registered volunteers with a nonprofit corporation organized under the laws of Oregon if the persons are providing services to homeless individuals or individuals at risk of becoming homeless. We had some testimony, and we were requested to carry over the public hearing portion to allow some out-of-town folks to come before the committee. And we have them here.
Okay, can I call Margaret Betch, Janet Brown, and Charles Hemingway, please? And please keep your testimony to a minimum if you can.
I talk very fast, I can. Hi, my name is Margaret Betch. I'm a registered nurse, and I come from St. Charles Health Systems in Bend, Oregon. I've been there for about 35, 36 years. I ran the ER at St. Charles Medical Center for about 33 years. About a month ago, we were at a luncheon, and I was given an award for working with this kind of group, and there were five representatives there. It was pretty doggone exciting. So I got to mention to all of them my compassion and my passion, okay, for the subject matter. I am here to testify as to why we need to delete the two words in House Bill 4027, does not. Okay, presently I'm in the medical branch director for homeless, and a project was called Project Connect. We meet once a year, and we service as many people as we can medically and with the dental issues that are out there. They used to have one in Portland. That one died. It was died because of liability issues. It also died because people got burned out. We have one in Central Oregon. We service anywhere between 400 to 500 patients for different medical and dental problems. We are the largest in the Northwest. However, we are getting to the point where it's almost not sustainable, and we're also burning out of providers. That is why I'm here today. We can get providers to attend these events because we use this major event as a disaster drill. In the state of Oregon, as long as these providers are signed up with an organization called Servor, okay, they will get liability insurance for the day, but it stops there. We also have minor or mini Project Connects that go out to the camps. We go out and set up in a church. We go to five or six or seven different communities in Central Oregon to service them as we can. We work very hard to get the providers to assist us with the mobile projects. However, attempting is getting too real, and people are backing out. This is the other Oregon law that they can sign, and they can sign it up with their nursing board or the Oregon board. This doesn't cover them. Their insurance companies say that over and over and over again. At the major Project Connect, I can get 50 physicians. I can get 20 dentists. I can get three or four acupuncturists. I can get all these providers to come and help us. But I'm down to about seven or eight when it comes to the mini projects because I can't get them anymore. I just lost another physician once he started realizing what we were doing, and he thought he was covered, and he is not. So I'm starting to lose physicians just like the Portland community did. There's another Project Connect in Eugene, by the way, just so you know, it's not just dedicated to Central Oregon. Over a year's time with the major and mobile projects, we see countless cases that would not or could not get medical services. I'm going to tell you a couple of those cases because they really are, they can really get to your heart and let you understand exactly why I'm here. We had four patients with breast lumps. We were able to screen them, and we were able to get them into Volunteers of Medicine. Okay, all four had breast cancer. They would have gone to the end stage and most likely have died. Okay, they came and were treated by our volunteer providers. Very, very important. You can imagine what this meant to those four women. We had a dental patient that became so ill from his infected teeth that we almost lost him medically. Your dental health affects your medical health. Okay, we were able to get his extractions, he got healthier, and he even got a job. And so that's the exciting things that we can provide for this. The post-traumatic stress veteran, we finally convinced to get some mental health service. Sometimes it's easier for some of these veterans to live in the woods because that way they don't have to deal with society when they do come back. I had one doctor's in Sisters, Oregon, when we set up a mobile connect there, that spent 2 hours with the gentleman. 2 hours he spent with him, and he was able to convince him to get into some systems. Because we do have the systems, if we can direct the people in the right way. Okay, who knows what would happen after that? You've heard the stories just as much as I have. All of these stories and 100 more were diagnosed and directed to the proper care that they could get because of these volunteer providers. We need these volunteer providers. I can get the nurses, okay, and I can get the dentists, and I can get the doctors, but I need help because of this bill. That's where I need it. I can make it happen, but I need help from you. I've seen the pain. I've seen the worry. I've seen the fear. And then I've also seen the excitement, and I've also seen the thank yous I frequently get from these patients. I never would have done this unless you were here, and they wouldn't have because they don't know how to access the system. You know how to access the system. I know how to access the system. People out there don't. They get confused, they get frightened, and they get scared. I've got a lot of young docs out there. I call them baby docs, but they're out there, and they want to volunteer. But they're scared to. Okay, they will not because of their fear of litigation. So that's why I'm imploring you to please look at this bill and removing those two words, giving them the immunity that they can have too. These people that we take care of out there, they're just like you or me. They just ran into bad times. They had a loss of a job, loss of a home, loss of a family, and the inability to mentally cope with what has happened to them. So there's a lot of systems we're affecting here. Providers are available, and they do want to help, but I need your help in order to change this bill so that I can get them to come and help us. Please consider this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. If I could interrupt you just a minute. Representative Wisnett, are you on a schedule? Or?
I'm good.
Okay. I'm trying to be sensitive to the fact that we have a lot of legislators who are literally in three committees today. So
yeah.
It's please continue.
Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee, my name is Janet Brown. I am from Redmond, Oregon, 621 Southwest 6th Street. I'm the Director of Policy for Partnership to End Poverty. We work in Deschutes, Crook, Jefferson Counties, and the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. I'm here today in support of House Bill 4027. Passage of this legislation will greatly benefit the low-income and homeless statewide by providing healthcare professionals who volunteer their time in outreach services assurance that there is immunity from liability. These people that they serve are in homeless camps and at community events where free services are provided. At the 9 signature events that our organization puts on, last year we served nearly 4,000 people with volunteers in social services, personal services, and medical services. By far, the greatest need is in the medical services. And we cannot get enough doctors, nurses, and dentists to volunteer because they tell us current and state federal law do not adequately or clearly define immunity outside of typical clinical settings. Even though they would like to volunteer, they are not due to the extra cost for additional insurance, and the liability factor. At each event, we are forced to turn away people who desperately need medical attention, leaving them with few options other than the emergency room, driving up debt and costs to our communities and hospitals. In order to get at the heart of why this legislation is needed, there needs to be an amendment to House Bill 4027 in Section 2 in its current form. In Section 2, Subsection B, which is page 2, line 10, we ask that you delete the two words "does not" so that it reads, "Outreach services include medical or dental services." Without the deletion of those two simple words, this bill will not include outreach services, the very reason the legislation is needed. We respectfully ask that you amend, as I outlined, or I understand there might be a dash 2 that you have, and pass House Bill 4027 and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
In that vein, I understand there are amendments in play. We don't have them today, so.
Oh, yeah, I looked back there. I was under that impression, too.
We are aware something may happen, but around here, that's not a guarantee it's happening.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Thompson, members of the committee, Representative Conger. My name is Chuck Hemingway. I am the Executive Director for Central Oregon Veterans Outreach. We have a medical van that goes out to camps, shelters, soup kitchens, other locations where homeless people can be found. Thank you for the opportunity to appear today and testify in support of House Bill 4027. I know your time is valuable in this session, and the fact that you're devoting your precious time to hear our modest proposal here is really appreciated. Our focus is on Section 2 of HB 4027. I've attached a copy of my additional remarks for your consideration. I believe it's in your packets. And I've included some expanded remarks at the bottom. And I've prepared a position paper that I've titled appropriately, I believe, The Gap-Filled Federal Volunteer Protection Act, a key reason why HB 4027 should be enacted. It wound up getting copied at the back of your materials rather than separately, but it's in that packet. Time permitting, I hope to cover some of the reasons why the Federal Volunteer Protection Act isn't the panacea it's claimed, nor is the reason why this legislation is not needed. In fact, it's the very reason, one of the very reasons why this legislation is needed. My statement has these key points summarized here in case I don't have time to talk about them fully in my spoken remarks. First, we mustn't lose sight of the fact that this legislation is broader than just doctors and dentists. It covers all volunteers, and please keep that in mind as you go through this process. Second, it's not a matter of educating the doctors about the provisions of ORS 676340 or 676345. They know about these provisions, and in spite of them, they don't think the protections are adequate. And you've got in your packet two letters from Dr. Randy Jacobs, who is our medical director on the medical van that goes out to the camps, discussing this issue. The fact that we have hundreds of doctors in Central Oregon, and we've only found eight willing to go out on the van, I think speaks volumes to the fact that the provisions of 676340 and 676345 were inadequate. And these doctors, those eight, they're paying out of their own pocket to ride along with us. And they're purchasing liability insurance because they know that these provisions are inadequate. Also in Section 2B, Line 10, as we've discussed, we would like to see the words does not stricken, and so that doctors and other medical providers are covered by the Act's protections. And I believe there's a dash 2 amendment that's circulating somewhere that would cure that. Now, the other day, you may have heard testimony, and you may hear again, that the problem with HB 4027 is that it deals with liability in general. That ain't right. It deals with liability in specific. HB 4027 is tailored narrowly. It deals only with the provision of narrowly defined outreach services. Thus, for example, a bus driver driving a homeless kid from a Boys and Girls Club to a place where his parents are couch surfing doesn't come within the ambit of HB 4027. It's too attenuated a circumstance. In fact, the Federal Volunteer Act specifically expressly excludes drivers from the protections of the Act, and that's one of the big gaps that we've identified is why we need this legislation. And again, this is no debate or choice between some two-tier system of justice versus expanding immunity in general. HB 4027 is a bill that brings justice to a system that has no tiers at all. The people we serve die out there, unattended, or they lose limbs, or they eat up preciously limited hospital resources with repeated ER visits and ambulance calls. Where is the justice in that, especially when you have a willing doctor who is scared to sign up despite the purported protections of the Oregon statutes and he can't afford the liability insurance? Where is the two-tier justice in that? So we think when you balance the ability to take medical care for free to a population that rarely gets any care at all, against a limited, narrow provision of immunity only provided under very tailored circumstances, we believe the balance falls in favor of HB 2027. So I invite you to read my expanded remarks and take a look at the memo that I put together, the position paper, and be happy to answer any questions you have.
Are there any questions for this panel?
Yeah.
Yes, please.
So a couple of comments. One, I guess just thank all three of you for coming over. I know it's a long drive, and the weather is uncertain. And so I appreciate very much your commitment to this cause, and I know this has been a long-term investment as well for all three of you. I wanted to mention a couple of things. Margaret said something about 7 to 8 healthcare providers are going out with the outreach effort. I'm pretty sure that's only a result of how incredibly persuasive and persistent Margaret is. Having been on the receiving end, you know, you mentioned that you got that award, and of course, I was sitting in the audience applauding, and you used that opportunity to hold forth on this very issue and recognize the lobbying opportunity when there were 5 legislators in the crowd and used it. So
it's the name.
Absolutely. it that's what it is. It goes with the name.
Margaret.
I wanted to point out that I think that the ongoing success of that effort is a reflection of the commitment of the community and you three in particular, and I appreciate it very much. I also wanted to add, in case it wasn't clear from the testimony, that what specifically is at issue here for us in Central Oregon are camps of homeless people. These are not people who will hop in their car because they don't have one and come into the clinic and access health care that might otherwise be available for free. These are people who need someone to come out to them, and this is where the issue arises. I also thought it was important, and this was said, but again, just to restate it for the record, this was said indirectly. The purpose of medical liability is to protect patients. And I think it's important. It's an important part of our healthcare system. It gives people who've been harmed by healthcare providers some recourse. But for these people who may not get healthcare at all otherwise, without the benefit of this volunteer effort, this enormous effort, there is no benefit to having medical liability if you don't get healthcare. There's no so the trade-off that we're talking about here is one that weighs heavily, heavily to the benefit of the folks who are receiving care from what you're doing. So support the bill very much. I hope we can get the Dash 2 amendments. I don't know who has control over those, but if we can get them, make them a part of the bill and work this, I would be very, very encouraged by that.
Thank you. I'd just like to say, Representative Congress spoke to me in length about the work you do. I'm extremely impressed with what you're accomplishing out there, and keep up the good work. I realize you're not the only people in the state doing it, but any place it's being done, you deserve applause. Anything else on this bill?
Did you want to call
the Representative? Absolutely. Okay. Thank you very much, and we will now call Representative Wisnant. Who I'm sure has an opinion on this bill.
Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlee, thank you very much, committee members, honorable colleagues. I'm just going to say thank you, thank you, thank you. Your chairs have kept this bill alive. If you notice, my name's not on the bill. It's a committee bill that started out in judiciary, and your chairs, and you're very blessed, Sandy, pay attention. You're very blessed. You're very blessed that your committee administrator has helped keep this thing alive. Please keep it alive. Please pass it. We've worked real hard. These people, as Representative Congress said, I'm Representative Gene Wisnant, House District 53, for the record. Sandy was panicked, wasn't watching us. But the trial lawyers have proposed amendments now. I think we have 3 sets of amendments. that I think we can work out and get this done. It's not about names on a bill. It's about people out there that need help, and let's make it happen this session. We don't want to go through another winter, two winters. We'll come back in 2013 to address this. I'm really happy that Mrs. Leonard has helped me work with the trial lawyers to get them on board since Mr. Sugarman was here, that he has some proposals. I think we can make it happen. We'll look forward to working as amendments. Again, thank you. Thank you very much for keeping it alive.
Any questions for Representative Wisnett for you? Thank you. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4027. Representative Kenemer.
Mr. Chair, a couple of our members were absent earlier, and I would like to move that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Parrish and Co-Chair Greenlich to vote on House Bill 4074, please.
So noted.
Without objection.
Who's asked for the call?
Are there any objections?
Any objections?
Yeah, you don't need a roll call.
No.
And then you just ask about
it. How would you vote?
I'm sorry, I was off testifying to another committee. I vote yes.
And I was out at my husband's retirement ceremony from his service in the military, so we just were racing back to get to.
I'm impressed that you made it back.
I was like, I got to go, no sandwiches, or, you know, we'll scarf a piece of cake on the way out the door. So I am a yes as well, and forgive my tardiness.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations. Thank you. That's important. It is important.
Okay.
With all the drama goes on. Something nice.
Okay, I think we're catching up here, my friends.
Yes.
We will now open a work session on House Bill 4128. Madam Administrator, would you please inform us?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4128 requires that health benefit plans to cover medically necessary dental or orthodontic services for the treatment of craniofacial anomalies. We adopted the Dash 1 amendment on Monday, the 6th of February, and you should have in your packet before you a Dash 2 amendment. And what the, well, Representative Foyle would love to explain what the Dash 2 amendments are.
Put the words right out of my mouth.
Yes, thank you for that opportunity to explain. So what this does is, first of all, I want to mention that this is a collaborative effort between the insurance industry and dental industry, and I want to specifically thank John Powell and Tom Holt for working with us along with the Dental Association. And this does is say that insurance who covers surgery, medical treatment for children with cleft palate will also cover orthodontic treatment, because this means there's less surgery and better outcomes. However, the way it was written, there was a concern from ODS that this might also mean that it would force them to cover TMJ treatment, and hence the Dash 1s came back with a $9 million fiscal. We did not intend for this to cover TMJ treatment, so we put in an amendment specifically stating that this bill does not cover for mandate that insurance companies cover TMJ treatment. And with the Dash 2 amendments, there is a minimal fiscal. So although there is a $9 million fiscal on the Dash 1s, with the Dash 2s, it comes with a minimal fiscal, does exactly what everyone wants, ensures that there's no kind of mandate that people didn't agree to, and it's a good bill and should pass. And thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to explain that.
Any other comments? Mr. Foyle, I would like to thank you profusely for this bill and all of the partners that worked to make it happen. This is the perfect outcome, a contentious bill that everybody finally comes together on, if we could only have that every time.
Just have to ask me.
I will. now that
you're on the record.
Now that you've made the offer, I have a number of bills we'll be talking about.
I might be busy.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 2912 to House Bill 4128.
Chair Greenlich has moved we adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 4128, dated 2912. Any discussion on the amendments? Is there any opposition to the amendments? Seeing and hearing none, I see a threatening look on the amendments are thereby attached.
Chair, I move House Bill 4128 to the floor as amended with the dash one and dash two amendments with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Greenlick has moved we move House Bill 4128 to the floor with the amendments and a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on that? Seeing none, call the roll, please.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Perry?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kinnamer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlick?
Aye.
And Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye. I suppose I'll be carrying it. I'm going to ask Representative Hoyle to carry this bill because I don't want to be killed on the way out of here because I didn't.
Thank you for that courtesy.
Quite all right. Okay. So I will now close the work session on House Bill 4128. And again, I thank all the parties that came together on that bill because it was not without concerns. And with that, we will now open a public hearing on House Bill 4109. And, Madam Administrator, if you would review the bill, please.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4109 requires the Oregon Health Authority to use a competitive bidding process for the purchase of generic drugs prescribed for recipients of medical assistance. It declares an emergency as an effective on passage. This has, in its current fashion, current form, the bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Widener, did you want to introduce this bill?
Yes, he does.
I guessed that, but
I have to tell you, we were chastised in the other committee for having too many Greenlick Widener, Widener Greenlick bills. So,
It just shows that bipartisanship can work.
He claimed it was all about nepotism. And I said, how is he and my father representing Widener?
State your name and it's yours.
For the record, State Representative Jim Widener representing Yamhill County, a little bit of Polk County, and hopefully it's going to change and I will go to Yamhill County and Washington County, so, and be closer to Representative Greenlick at that point.
I'm moving away.
So, unless he moves out of the state, or east, yes. So it's what I'm handing out. I'm not going to read my testimony to you. You'll have it on the front cover. But if you look through, and I want to thank the pharmacist and different people for getting their concerns to me ahead of time so we could go over them and everything. And it's what I have is the concerns listed, 1 through 9, and responses. And I'm going to walk through those with you today. So because one of the things, when I put this bill together, I wanted to make sure we got it right. We spent a lot of time last session working on this, and I was having all kinds of problems with the drafting and everything that was going on at LC. We got things squared away. It was too late in the process to actually do a bill last time or get one, a clean bill to healthcare to where we could do something. But this time I felt very good about the product that we came out with once it came out. And then, as everybody knows, at the last minute, everybody comes in as concerned, and all of a sudden they hate your bill and want to kill your bill after you're...
Well, welcome to a short session.
Fairly long in the process. So, and the reason this bill came about is... I've been watching a lot of stuff that we do in state government and seeing lots of problems. One of the things that's amazed me is that we don't have an enterprise system that cuts across for all state agencies so we can see what's being spent, whether it's Maximo, JD Edwards, SAP. There's lots of systems out there that can be used for that so you can actually track and budget things in a very fast and efficient manner. Where here, when we go to find things out, it takes forever to get information out of departments and what's going on. So starting off with number one, if you look on the testimony that I handed to you, pharmacies already negotiate the lowest price for generic drugs with the manufacturers, is what they had told me in my office and what they had sent on their thing. But one of the things that I wasn't sure is if this was a quantifiable fact, that pharmacies already acquire generic drugs at the lowest price. It would be beneficial to disclose how pharmacies can prove that their method already acquires the generic drugs at the lowest cost possible, with the state of Oregon spending $90 million a biennium on purchase of generic drugs. We believe the purchasing power through collective bargaining on behalf of the state's Medicaid program could drive down the cost through bidding process, much like proven results of Walmart bidding process due to their size and acquiring generics at $4 when other pharmacies already thought they had the lowest prices. This displays that size of purchasing power incentivizes the manufacturer to push down their manufacturing production to find means of streamlining their process to complete or to compete. And the reason this comes about, I worked with lots of larger companies where we'd negotiate chemical contracts, oil contracts, or parts, and we'd go out to bid with companies, and if we did a certain volume, there were rebates that happened. This has been recognized on the brand name drugs, but not on the generics that we're talking about in this bill. And the generics are where we truly have the competition at work in the marketplace with multiple generic manufacturers in one location that would be competing for our business and going when we put out a request for proposal or an RFQ request for buying basically from the state of Oregon. So the second concern they had was maximum allowable cost. This is what they call MAC. MAC is a pricing list which is set. A cost reflects the market cost by setting maximum cost standards after negotiations. This is something that we do in the industry where I come from, where we have a list price. We look at our cost of manufacturing. We know what it costs for our distribution, what it's going to cost for different distributors that are in the line of our process, and it could be anywhere from a 3x to a 4x multiplier, knowing that with a guy who's just selling product and not stocking anything, he might get a 15% commission. A stocking distributor might get 25%, or if he's just distributing the product, 25%. If they're keeping large inventory on the shelf, they might be looking at 35, 40% discounts off of the list price. And I believe that's where the MAC price is that we set for them. The MAC is a set price of list cost ceiling, not the floor, to save valuable state resources while providing quality medical assistance for Oregonians using state-funded programs. We are not just concerned about maximum purchase price, but rather the minimum purchase price. The maximum allowable cost is the maximum cost that will be paid. If the lower price is negotiated, the MAC is still paid to the state of Oregon, or the state of Oregon still billed at the MAC. The difference between the negotiated price and the MAC could be substantial between the state of Oregon recouping those dollars. Furthermore, a bidding process drives down cost and creates a competitive environment where fear of losing a major client who spends $90 million a biennium like the state of Oregon causes manufacturers to reassess their stated production costs to conform to the demands of the larger collective purchaser. This is something we do when we negotiate large contracts. Lots of times we'll move our representatives or the rep that we have in areas, and we negotiate the contracts direct with us as the manufacturing facility. And the other day I was doing a large bid against another competitor, and I cut my price 40%. So there are large savings that are there to be had if we start negotiating direct with the manufacturers. Concern three, it is very unlikely that any savings realized from the proposed bidding process would be less than the cost of the administered program. Our office inquired into potential savings that could occur should a competitive bidding process generics be instituted. Tom Burns of the Oregon Health Authority, who worked with us on this, what he said, as to savings, there will be savings if we assume that the same 3% across the board we get on brand products. Tom went on to say that the savings estimates of the bidding process that would yield a 3% savings equates to $1.3 million. Surely this program won't cost the state of Oregon $1.3 million to administer per biennium. This is after all competitive bidding programs, something that many governments implemented on a regular basis. I think 3% is very, very conservative. I think we're going to see a much greater savings than 3%. I think with the $90 million biennium, I would not be surprised if we saw more, because I know Walmart negotiates a much lower contract for their pricing on the drugs, yet when they fill a prescription, I can almost guarantee you they're charging us the MAC. So they might be paying $4, the MAC is $10, or it might be $20, and they will be charging the state of Oregon the $20. And I haven't seen anything in any of the billing that comes back to show me differently. Another concern the pharmacists have, that they would have to carry duplicate inventory of generic drugs for customers who use the state's assistance program and require the state's preferred generic drugs. Pharmacists already carry duplicate stocks for most of the products they sell. Why shouldn't the state ensure that it pays the lowest rate possible? Just an example, and this is a very good example that I got thinking about of where government's involved, but nine grocery stores carry 9 brands of cheese, 6 brands of baby formula for the WIC program, and they haven't recorded complaints of higher operating costs due to shelving and organizing. And if you walk in the grocery store, walk through the baby formula, you'll see what's WIC approved because they put the WIC label in front of it. So once this is negotiated, if they're seeing Medicaid, Medicare clients, they can keep it on their shelves, and it wouldn't be called WIC, it'd be Oregon Prescription Drug or whatever we end up with the name for it, and that would probably be handled in the rulemaking process. Number 5, pharmacists would be faced with the dilemma of incurring a penalty and selling the prescription at a loss, or having the patient wait until they could obtain the state preferred drug. This is one thing we covered in the bill. In Section 1, Subsection 3 of the bill, it clearly states that pharmacies are not prohibited from substituting another generic drug for the prescribed generic if the pharmacist normally carries the prescribed generic but is temporarily out of stock. The concern about a generic refill other than the state's preferred generic, which many of which cost more than what the patient has to pay under Medicaid program to the state assistance, can be worked out within the rulemaking process of the program so that the pharmacist will not incur the burden of the cost of differential and lose money through the non-preferred generic prescription refill. Concern 6, there is no guarantee that the lowest bid would be the best price. Page 1, line 22 through 23 defines the competitive bidding process as generic manufacturers to enter into proposed contract to sell product at the lowest price. These companies would enter into a process with the understanding that they are prepared to offer the most competitive bid to acquire the $90 million biannual contract with the state of Oregon. We know that competition reduces prices. For instance, Similac baby formula is the WIC-approved formula based on the contract negotiations. But that doesn't mean that the stores can't carry Nestle's, Enfamil, or Carnation. Generic drug companies should bid for the market share. Baby formulas negotiate for their business, and there is no reason Medicaid shouldn't do the same. Concern 7, would pharmacists be expected to buy special stock of the preferred state generic drugs and keep that separate from the stock of generics set aside for non-Medicaid or state assistance recipients? Pharmacists would operate just as they do currently with the preferred drug list for name brand prescriptions, as noted above. This process is done by several industries that operate alongside government programs, like grocery stores do with the WIC program. What would happen if the winning generic manufacturer was unable to meet the demand of the pharmacies? Section 1, subsection 3 addresses this concern again. The generic manufacturer who partakes in the program understands the volume required. Oregon is highly unlikely to be the cause of the generic drug shortage and will not break the system. Also, the recent bird flu scare didn't prevent the maker of Tamiflu from meeting the demand, which prompted a quick increase in production to meet nationwide demands. Concern 9 is, couldn't significant savings be achieved through encouraging a higher rate of generic dispensing? This argument is not an innovator brand name drug with different active ingredients. This bill is about generic drugs that all have the same active ingredients as their competition. Why shouldn't the state attempt to obtain the best prices possible? Furthermore, a national average holds that around 80% of all dispensed drugs within Medicaid system are generic drugs. This is where the mass quantity is, and the piece that we're going after is where the big savings would be. But as you can see, the bill I brought before you, just off going what we have received from Tom Burns in the Oregon Health Authority, is $1.3 million at 3%. I sit here before every one of you, and I think it's bigger than that. I think when we send out an RFP at $90 million to a lot of generic prescription drug manufacturers, we're going to see a larger reduction. So, because they're going to negotiate directly with the state, I think one of the problems that we're going to run into, and I don't know if it'll be addressed, but there's dispensing fees that we've put on pharmacists. And the state doesn't pay pharmacists very well for their dispensing fee. And I think this is where the underlying issue is, and I think this is something that would have to be addressed and done in the rulemaking process. And I know we've talked about a work group and everything, but I would really like to move this bill to Ways and Means and get it moving a little quicker so we can start getting RFPs out and get this process going, and any rules that need to be changed or any laws that need to be changed at that point we can achieve in February. But at least we have the bids coming in and we're ready to go when we're here in that February session, because the trend line's still going down on revenue coming into this state. To put this off, I think, is a disservice to state government. It's a disservice to the taxpayers of Oregon. And I think it's something that we need to address and tackle right now. I know there's been fiscals put on this. I know Tom suggested it's going to take two full-time employees to do this. I think if we had the right system in place, enterprise system, putting out an RFP is not very hard. You just pull up the drug systems in it. I don't know what we're using for going out to bid right now or how they're doing their request for proposals, but it's something that needs to happen, and I think the taxpayer of Oregon deserve us to investigate this and move this along quickly and get the ball rolling. With that, I'm open to any questions.
Anything?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, any comment, please? Yeah. Representative Widener, we have talked to Tom Burns about it. Unfortunately, he has to be in Portland for some other administrative emergency, if you can put those two words together today. But he really tells me that in its current form, he doesn't think it's possible for the state to actually do it. He thinks it's an important thing to do. So Representative Thompson and I have decided that we will create a work group where you and I and Burns will head up with some other interested people and see if we can figure out how to perfect it in a way that they feel comfortable with it. We're taking it seriously, and it's an important bill.
That's one of the things, I mean, when we sit down, even with this going forward, it's going to need a work group. We're going to have to stay on top of this and keep this thing rolling quickly, but I think we're going to be innovative on how we purchase drugs in the state of Oregon, and we could be a model for other states on how we negotiate, because right now we negotiate different than every other industry out there for buying prescription drugs. We're negotiating off a list price. We're not negotiating off cost plus, we're negotiating off list. And that's backwards in my mind for doing it.
Yeah, she's not even a list, it's a mythical list.
Yes, exactly. So,
questions for Representative Widener? Please.
I think just a comment. With non-generic drugs, we do have a competitive process with carve-out for certain drugs where it's important to have those carve-outs. But I do believe that there are cost savings here. Again, taking into account what we are compensating our pharmacists for in distribution, making sure that people have access to the drugs that they need. But if we can save money and at the state, and we can get people the drugs that they need through a competitive process by using the covered lives that we have, given the state of where our budget is, I think it's irresponsible not to step forward and do something. We cannot afford to leave money on the table.
You were volunteering for the work group then, or?
I was hoping we could vote on the bill.
Anyone else?
We'd like to.
Okay, you're welcome to stay around if you'd like. We have more people. Chris Bonoff, please. Oh, I'm sorry, did I miss someone?
No.
No, please. Oh, yes, absolutely.
Just don't put his name up.
Yeah. If you've been here before, you know the drill.
Almost. Representative or Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee. I'm Chris Bonap. I'm Executive Director for the Oregon State Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I guess for the record, I'm here not to hate the bill or kill it, so I hope that my comments aren't interpreted in that way. The bill did raise some concerns for us in that in the world of mental health, all generics are not created equal. They may have the same active ingredient, but they have different fillers. They have different time release of that active ingredient. And so it raised some concerns among our organization and the people we represent. For us, as Representative Hoyle indicated, there are certain medications that we have to have them widely available because the individual reactions to each of those medications is vastly different, even among generics. And in the testimony, I highlight one of the key medications for schizophrenia, clozapine, which has two generic manufacturers, and the individual reaction to those generics is vastly different. Also, in our population, just the fact of in a competitive bidding process that may lead to a switch in medication to something that looks different can be very problematic, especially for people with symptomology that's still very disruptive to their cognitive abilities. That act of change can be interpreted as a threat, and then suddenly have people who are resistant to treatment and not adherent to their medications. And that is an issue that people and providers in the field deal with, particularly with a subset of population, again, where symptomology is very significant. The other piece I did want to call attention to is we do have protections in the state for the carve-out of mental health medications. We are concerned, although it's unclear to us how this would apply to generics in class 7-11 for antidepressants and antipsychotics, but I did also want to highlight those medications that are subject to regulation, anticonvulsants and medications for ADHD, where we also see the same things, is that you have multiple generics available, you also have brand name, and the individual reaction to each one is different, again, based on the manufacturing process, based on the composition, and based on the biology of the individual. So what we would encourage is if this bill moves forward or if there's a work group, if we might be able to participate, is to inject those concerns and see that they get addressed so that we're not having an unintended consequence on a very vulnerable population. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, please? Yes.
Co-sponsor of this bill, I would be very supportive of the addressing the issues that Mr. Bonoff has brought up, because they're serious issues. They're very important. And again, this is a population that, with access to the appropriate medication and appropriate treatment, can lead really fully productive lives. And so it is a critical and important piece. And again, I would be very supportive of having you working with us and addressing those concerns in the bill.
Thank you very much.
I think these are important issues, too. I've just gone through a week with my 90-year-old mother-in-law convincing her that a switch in the color of her tablet from the pharmacy didn't mean it's a new medication. And, we'll get there. But these are big issues for some people on the generics level, is to make everybody understand that what that means and how it applies to them. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Okay, last but not least, I would like to call Bill Cross, Shelley Bailey, and Jackson Long. All else fails on how to make a bill work, you call in the pharmacy community.
Mr. Co-Chair, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. And I'm distributing a letter from those organizations expressing concern about the bill as drafted. It's not clear to us exactly how it would work, whether or not it would achieve the kind of savings that would offset possible costs. We do know that in Indiana they explored a similar approach and determined not to go forward because the costs actually exceeded the savings. We do have some concerns about how it would work in the marketplace and how it would work for patients as well. And so I've got Shelley Bailey and Jackson Long here to talk about some of those issues.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, and members of the House Health Committee. For the record, my name is Shelley Bailey, and my partner, Gary Lundgren, and myself own Central Drugs Pharmacy, a 109-year-old independent community pharmacy in Portland, Oregon. Today, I wish to express strong opposition to House Bill 4109. I believe that the legislation will be damaging to the state and to Oregon pharmacies for three reasons. First, I expect the proposed legislation will actually cost the state money, will result in access challenges to patients, and will have a negative financial impact on the pharmacies serving these clients. One thing I must convey that has not been addressed in previous testimony is how the state actually pays for generics currently. Since January 1st, 2011, the state actually pays pharmacies for generics based on acquisition cost. The state decided to pursue a new payment methodology that invoices pharmacies once a year on their acquisition cost for generics and pays pharmacies per unit as an average of these costs plus a professional dispensing fee. So the flawed assumption with the proposed legislation is that the state can and will negotiate savings at every opportunity for every drug, for every strength, buying and pricing that is more advantageous in the current market. Second, the bill will result in access issues for clients receiving medical assistance. Testimonies have already been put forth regarding the fact that there would be some provisions to help remediate that, but I can note, given my professional experience, that any impediment to a client getting a specific medication, whether that is through prior authorization channels or other alternative means of pharmacies getting the information to the state, results in delays to clients in receiving care. Whereas patients who are not receiving benefits from the medical assistance program are able to quickly get an alternative generic manufacturer because the pharmacy is real-time able to make those changes. Third, the legislation has unintended consequences for pharmacies. As the supply and price of generics are highly volatile, our pharmacy actually checks which generic manufacturer to stock daily to make sure that we are always buying the generic manufacturer that is, one, available in the marketplace, so we actually get product the next day, opposed to ordering perhaps an alternative manufacturer we'd had the day before that won't have supply for the next day. And we also check pricing. So again, as I've highlighted, given that pharmacies are invoiced, provide these invoice acquisition costs to the state and are paid off of these acquisition prices, I certainly do not support the legislation. So for the reasons given, the proposed legislation will likely cost the state more money, will create access challenges for pharmacies and for patients receiving medical assistance. I also wish to highlight that there are currently lots of supply-related issues with respect to generics right now. The FDA has noted that of these shortages, over 80% of these are for generics. So I think it's really important to highlight these shortage-related issues as we further have this dialogue. And I do welcome questions.
I think we'll get all of your testimony, then we'll open for questions.
Thank you. Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, and members of the House Committee on Healthcare. I wanted to share, as a pharmacist, my name is Jackson Leong, and I'm a practicing pharmacist. I take care of Oregon citizens that are seniors, and I take care of those that are in mental health. And this bill very much concerns me regarding patient care. I've not heard and I've not read a lot about the testimonies that people have been sending through about patient care. And I can represent my business here, but my foremost concern is about patient care. As Chris identified, we have a group of drugs out there that people are not aware of. They're called narrow therapeutic index drugs. And drugs are not drugs as the FDA defines, because these narrow therapeutic index drugs are things like anti-epileptic drugs, the anticonvulsant drugs that result in people being taken care of and not having seizures. We deal with things that are warfarins, Coumadin, brand name products, things that are anticoagulants. These drugs work very, very carefully within the human body. There's not a lot of degree of trial and error that can be had with them and come with inappropriate consequences. And so these drugs have to be monitored by laboratory results. I used to be a corporate compliance officer for a company, and I traveled. And in reading the state laws of 10 different states, many of them had very clear rules that prevented people from tampering with these neurotherapeutic index drugs. If you do it inappropriately, they end up having seizures. They end up having to be stabilized. And to be stabilized, they have doctor visits. And if you change them and they don't know about it, then the unfortunate consequences is a potential emergency room visit. So as we look at these drugs, which clozapine happens to be one of them, which Chris talked about, and he talked about the color differences. I've received numerous phone calls, and I still have one recorded, that actually shares with me a patient's concern of, are you trying to poison me? You sent me out something that is totally a different color. The mentally ill patients, they don't recognize this. They're stabilized. The physicians work very hard at trying to make sure that they understand how to take their medications. And I understand the intent of the bill. It's trying to help save costs. But at what expense? So we have to take a very, very careful look at this to make sure that this bill is written in a manner that if it is going to go through, that it supports the needs of the patients out there, not to hurt them. We should take the time to look at this and make sure it is very effective. And so, in closing, I can also talk about the issues with the burdens of my workflow and the work issues of having stock. We use technology, and the technology requires us to be able to have cassettes that have $70 to $100 to have them each calibrated for each drug. If I have to do this, not just our pharmacy, but any pharmacy that uses technology, that's an unknown cost. But I don't want to really talk that much about that. My main thing was just to try and make the committee understand about healthcare. It is about the people. It is about trying to make sure that we don't give them drugs that are dangerous to them. Not all of them are dangerous, sir. I understand that. But there are a lot that are, and this bill does not address it, and it needs to be looked at more carefully.
Mr. Chair.
If there's questions, I'm very open to them.
Co-Chair Greenlick, I thought you might have a question or comment.
I'm intrigued with your statement. You may not have noticed, but we've agreed to generic drugs 20 years ago. And this isn't about that. This is about how the state buys drugs we've agreed to. Do you not approve of, I think you're saying you're at least 20 years behind the times if you don't approve of generic drugs. Is that who
no,
you are?
No, we dispense about 3,000 or 4,000 prescriptions a day. The majority of them are generic drugs. What I'm saying is that if the state is allowing only one generic brand to be purchased for that one particular drug and strength, you're going to put people who have been stabilized on narrow therapeutic drugs at a very high risk.
But even if this is inside the narrow therapeutic limit?
Yes. As in one of my letters that I sent out to you, the American Epilepsy Society, back in 2007 when generics started coming out for some of these medications, they made it very clear that even though the FDA says that this is the same drug ingredient, it's the same strength, it does not necessarily work the same. The dissolution of the drugs works very differently. It's like, you know, I guess in simple terms, if I may, it's like cooking. You get a recipe for something, it's the greatest dessert you've ever had, you say to the chef, I'd like to have that recipe. You go home, you cook it up, and it is absolutely horrid. It doesn't look the same, it doesn't taste the same. Drugs are extremely dangerous, and we all understand that. We cannot compare them to diapers and food products and other things out there, because we all work differently, and when we ingest them, they work differently.
And I was a pharmacist before you were born, and the issue of generics, I mean, really has long since been settled. Yes, there are good generics and bad generics, and there are good brand name drugs and bad brand name drugs. This bill isn't about whether we're going to use generics.
I understand.
This bill is about how the state buys generics that we've decided are okay to use for. So, I mean, I don't think we need a lesson on the generic question. The issue is, why shouldn't the state be able to save money on generics that have already been agreed to that fit in that narrow therapeutic range and are the proper color and do whatever needs to be done? That's the issue. And you seem to be here saying that, well, the state shouldn't save money, even though we've agreed to use generics.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I clearly am not stating appropriately for, I hopefully not everyone here in understanding is, I am pro-generic. We use generics regularly.
Are you also pro the state saving money?
Absolutely.
Okay.
But I'm also concerned that if we, even though, again, all these drugs are approved by the FDA, as we heard testimony earlier about narrow therapeutic type drugs, they do not work appropriately. I'm not saying all of them. I'm saying the committee, when we look at it, when you look at it, has to be very careful about looking at that group of drugs because it isn't just one class. It's a wide class. The majority of the generics out there are perfectly fine probably looking at this perspective. But this bill does not address looking more carefully at that class of drugs. And that's what I'm asking is that even though you can buy them all the same, even though they're all regulated by the FDA, they do not all work the same with that small group of drugs.
If I understand then, what you're saying is that if there are three or four drugs that are generics for the same thing, we ought not purchase one of them at a low price thinking we're saving money when we needed all four.
That is part of it, yes, for that group. I'm not saying for 90% of the drugs that are proven to be normal for people, but this group of narrow therapeutic index drugs that most people are not aware of what they are, but clinicians are. Generics, yes, they're good. They save money. They work, for the most part, the same. But those people that need these special types of drugs, we put them at danger. And that's all I'm asking is for the committee to please look at that group and be sure that we are not going to allow that to be just only one and have these people have problems from it.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of getting conflicting testimony between the two of you because we want to make sure this bill's right. Because you said you go out and you look at what generics available on the market, so you could be changing generic prescriptions on a person is what you testified in correct?
And what I wasn't specific about is we're actually leveraging the buying power of our wholesaler. So we're not just buying based on the pricing and the availability of what Central Drug as one independent pharmacy can buy. We're purchasing based on what has been negotiated by a national wholesaler based on product availability and pricing. But we do daily secure what manufacturer we purchase based on availability and price.
So you're changing the generic on a person. They might show up one time, get it.
On some medications, I think I'll let Jackson speak for himself, but my understanding of what Jackson is saying is that for specific products, it's not therapeutically appropriate, but right. we also make that decision to not change on clients as well.
Which, and you're looking at the 10% of the generic market that we have to be careful with.
Correct.
Because when you're getting into anticoagulants and things like that, this is something, I mean, I'm on Lipitor. So I got there's a generic for Lipitor made by the same guys. But there, the doctor is going to tell you, this is what I want. You would have to make the conscious decision to take them off of that because that's a very limited drug. And if you go to a different brand, that could screw up a person and they end up in the emergency room. We're not touching that in this bill. I don't see where we're doing anything like that. And with the 10%, I mean, doctors can override this at any point and say, we're going to use the brand name or we're going to do this. We're not taking that ability away from a doctor.
Sure.
So we're just trying to get the best price on the generic market, which is 80% of the market. So how is that a health concern?
I'm
not getting
it. Yeah, as a pharmacist, I'm not communicating very well, I guess, in trying to get that concern. Lipitor, there's no problem with that. Pharmacies switch them. Doctors don't care if you switch from brand to generic and different generics to different generics. But what they will be concerned about is if you're on warfarin and you change to one of the other warfarins out there, even if the strength, you've been on one strength of warfarin and then the doctor changes it, a pharmacy should stay within that same brand because it's shown to be stable. When you go outside of that, so I'm on one, let's say I'm epileptic, okay? Let's say I'm epileptic, and I'm on my phenytoin. I've been on my generic phenytoin since it came out, but since it's come out, there's been five or six more manufacturers that start making it. I'm stable on this. My blood levels that I go in every 6 months to have reviewed show that I'm stable. If I all of a sudden, because of the state, trying to save money, I get it, but in this group, if they don't address this group of drugs, and all of a sudden you say that only this brand's covered, then I'm going to use that generic brand that the state says. I'm going to administer it to myself, thinking that's going to be okay, but it's a narrow therapeutic. I go home and I have a seizure, and I hurt myself. I'm in trouble. I'm not saying they're all bad, sir. I'm just trying to say that this bill does not address narrow therapeutics. I don't see anything in there. So it leaves it wide open, whether it be respectable pharmacies or not respectable pharmacies, to just say, I'm going to switch it because I'm saving money. My pharmacy, I will not let them switch these drugs unless we talk to the doctor. That's the recommendation of the American Epilepsy Association. That's just one group of drugs there. But there's other ones that also have similar statements, whether it be thyroid medications, et cetera. So I'm not trying to bait and say that the program isn't designed to be good. There are business aspects of it, but I'm trying to say from a healthcare perspective, the bill does not say anything about carving out and watching out after these drugs and having exceptions for that group. Does that make sense, sir?
Well, I think we are to the point where I thought we were going to end up. We have a very complicated bill in a very short session, and it's only 9 months to the next session, not 2 years. So this was the point of the discussion we had earlier today about maybe this thing needs to move to a work group for further discussion, and I would welcome all of you to be participatory in that and see if we can iron these things out and make sure we do the right thing before we do something else. I know, as a body, speaking for my own experience, I have never endorsed a bill that wasn't perfect, but occasionally we do get one out of here that's not quite perfect, and this is a very serious matter. So I think we will conclude there. I would invite all of you who are interested to be cognizant of participating in the work group as you can, and we will continue this discussion at a later time.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Co-Chair, before you gavel out, I'll be passing around some written testimony in opposition to House Bill 4109 from the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association.
Thank you. Okay, friends, I believe we have concluded the work for today. Oh,
make sure Sandy's here.
Right.
Do the scorekeeping here. We have a unanimous vote almost that we are completed the work of the day. The healthcare committee is adjourned. Thank you for your attendance.
Next question. No.